It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, living like a caveman. There are a lot of people right now who swear by the paleo lifestyle. They stay in shape by lifting heavy stones, climbing trees, and running barefoot. They eat a Stone Age diet of meat, fish, roots, and nuts, and their inspiration is a phenomenally fit 76-year-old retired economist. Arthur Devaney believes we're meant to live like our prehistoric ancestors.
They were foraging broadly over territory. They used their sprinting ability to either capture prey, to kill prey. For example, they ran them into pits and leapt into the pits and killed bison and horses and what have you. Or they chased animals, and of course they were chased by animals. So the speed pathway is a very critical and neglected aspect of modern fitness approach, which primarily emphasizes aerobic metabolism, routine, dull activities on a treadmill, steady state sort of thing. The body, you need to disturb homeostasis in the body so that it will adapt.
Have you invented any exercises to try to do what you're talking about?
Well, primarily I emphasize the strength pathway. Sprinting, intermixed with walks. I don't think there's any exercise anyone could possibly invent these days, but I do have a protocol in terms of the way I work out in the gym, because it's absolutely crucial to maintain your muscle mass to stave off aging. I've done that successfully. I still weigh 200 pounds and have for 50-some-odd years.
Even more remarkable, what I've read about you is, what's your ratio of fat to muscle?
Well, 8% body fat.
I can barely even
ridiculous.
Imagine that.
You're
just
it
a
is
big
ridiculous.
Walking pile of muscle and bone, I guess.
Well, maybe, but very active and a very caring, warm person as well. Not a muscle head.
What does your doctor say at your annual checkups?
He says, someday when I grow up, I want to be just like you. He's 45 years old. He thinks I'm a marvel, but I think it's just the natural way to live. You don't have to age the way people are aging.
Now, I was asking you about your exercise routine. One I've read about that you didn't mention is you occasionally pull your Land Rover with a rope?
I do, yes. I pull it up the slope of my driveway. I imagine that pulling a... Yes, yes, of course. I imagine I'm pulling a bison out of a pit.
A Land Rover weighs what, 5,000-6,000 pounds?
Close to 6,000. It's a big Range Rover that I have. And
you can actually move it.
I can. I can move it quite some distance up the slope of the driveway. And then I let it down, and I try to stop it. I don't put the brakes on. I think there needs to be a little bit of risk in life, too, and I hope it doesn't run into my office.
Well, now I have to ask, what do you eat to fuel that kind of expenditure of energy?
I eat rather sparingly. I don't know my caloric intake. I never have counted it in all my life, but some days it's probably 5,000 calories. Other days it's nothing, and I do everything in between. There's no ordinary day in terms of eating. Let's see, this morning I had leftover flank steak that I had done on the grill with a bit of cantaloupe, about half a cantaloupe, and maybe about a pound of meat in the flank steak. Remember, flank steak's very lean, so it was a nice meal.
Uh-huh. And what will you have for dinner?
Tonight I think we're planning steaks, although last night we had the flank steak with asparagus and a beautiful salad and fresh artichokes that were steamed. We eat wonderfully, really. We eat abundantly. My wife is a wonderful Italian cook, and she took my originally Paleolithic style of chunky grilled eating and turned it into this wonderful, I call it the Paleolithic Mediterranean cuisine, because it's...
What don't you eat?
I don't eat bread. I don't eat rice. I don't eat potatoes. I don't eat beans. I don't eat milk.
So pretty much you don't eat any of the foods that humans developed after they moved to an agrarian society. Is that right?
That would be a fair statement. I do try to mimic, with modern foods, the pattern that would have prevailed during the Paleolithic.
Arthur Devaney is a retired economist and the guru of the paleo movement. His lifestyle has inspired, among other things, a Tumblr fan site called Art Devaney Eats Vegans. He's 76 years old. So here's our question about the paleo diet. How do we know what people ate 15,000 years ago, or what we've evolved to eat? If there's anyone who knows early humans, it's John Hawkes. He's an anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he's got a lab filled with early hominid skeletons. He also writes a wildly popular paleoanthropology blog. Steve Paulson asked for his take.
So what do you think of those people who are eating raw meat or running around in the desert, doing tests of endurance and strength and all of that, who say they are the modern incarnation of the Paleolithic man?
You know, it's really interesting because I actually think we can learn a lot from people. You know, when you take your premises seriously, when you say, I'm going to just do what I can, limiting myself to what was available in the past, then you learn a lot about what's possible in the past. But carrying through those assumptions and letting them play out, you learn a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who lived in Biosphere 2 learned that doesn't work. You know? So it's okay to have a failed experiment. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, my dad was into black powder rifle shooting, and we would go to rendezvous, and we were really serious about seeing the lifestyle that was possible in the American West. And I think there's a sense to which keeping alive some semblance of a tradition and seeing what you can accomplish without the technologies we have now, that's wonderful. I think that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Now, the argument for those who like the Paleolithic diet is that it was healthier, that people had less disease, they weren't obese, and that's the reason why we should try to eat that way today.
The simple way to not be obese today is to stay really active and keep yourself hungry. I mean, the fundamental thing about foragers in small-scale human societies is that they're hungry a lot of the time, and that's certainly been true through our evolutionary history. You know, we've eaten the foods that make sense for us. We are adapted to a diverse diet.
So you study this era in history. This has not changed your personal diet at all?
No, but if you're going to try to reconstruct accurately what the diet of the past was, you know, you're thinking about the lean meats that are available to you, you've got to think about pulling lizards out of holes and, you know, grabbing the tail of an armadillo. You know, it's the sort of thing that if you were walking around where you live and eating foods that you can see, it's going to be a lot more squirrels than it is elk in your freezer.
Right. Now, the other piece of this argument, I mean, that what you hear from the advocates of the Paleolithic diet is that we really haven't changed that much. We have not evolved much in the last, let's say, 10 or 20,000 years, that our ancestors were pretty much who we are today. And that's why it would make sense to go back and eat the way they did.
Yeah, this is a tremendous, interesting part of anthropology now. It's some of my work. We work on how our genes have adapted to agriculture. People really have changed. And that makes the story more complex. Humans were never one thing before agriculture. We were adapted to different ecologies. But after agriculture is introduced, this new food source and our new way of dealing with foods has introduced a lot of selective pressures on us. The best known of them is lactase. When people began to keep dairy animals and began to drink a lot of milk, it's normal for humans to lose the ability to digest milk as they age. You know, when you're a baby, you have milk, but when you're 23, you don't. Mm-hmm. And our normal response to that is to turn off the enzyme, lactase, that digests milk sugar.
So this is not specifically cow's milk then?
No, it's also goat milk, sheep milk, camel milk in some human groups, mare's milk. They all contain this sugar, lactose. In human guts that have lactose that comes into them, there are bacteria that will be really happy to digest that for you. And they create a lot of gas and some lactic acid as a side effect. And so that's uncomfortable for people. This is the normal human state, is for it to be uncomfortable to drink a lot of fresh milk. People who have lived in agricultural populations for 8,000, 10,000 years tend to have a higher frequency of a new mutation that allows them to digest this milk. It's a lactase altering mutation that makes us produce it as adults. So it's a really clear example of how we've changed in response to diets. That doesn't mean that drinking lots and lots of milk is never going to create a problem for you dietarily, but it means that we're adapted to eat this in a way that humans in the past weren't.
So we're constantly evolving is what you're saying. I mean, we're still evolving.
Yeah. We're a changing system. It's a complex system. There's no single gene that makes you more healthy. You carry a legacy of your past. Some of that legacy is from 50,000 years ago, and some of that legacy is from 5,000 years ago. And depending on which genes you've inherited, you might be better at dealing with some agricultural foods. You might be worse. And better might mean you concentrate the energy from it faster, which in today's environment might not be such a good thing. In early agriculturalists who underwent famines, that was probably great. You know, so we've got this legacy, and it means that today it's hard for us to predict what's the most healthy diet for you. It totally depends on which genes you happen to have.
What I find so fascinating about all of this, I mean, whether we're talking about the Paleolithic diet or barefoot running, is there seems to be a romance about the way our ancestors used to live. It's sort of the idea is that everything went downhill with civilization, with the advent of agriculture, you know, roughly 10,000 years ago, that there was sort of this more primal, purer state that humanity once lived in.
Yeah. People are really attracted to that. We evolved. We overcame challenges in the past. It's really fair to describe the human story as one of achieving great things. On the other hand, people who lived more than 30,000, 40,000 years ago, they had a very low chance of surviving to adulthood. You know, you're talking about 20, 30%, 40% child mortality. They had a low chance of surviving up to age 40. People who reached adulthood in Neanderthals, more than two-thirds of them were dead by the time they were 40.
Do we know why?
We don't know why. They lived a hard life, right? We see the signs of injuries on several of their skeletons. We see that they were undergoing frequent stress as children because we see the lines in their teeth that come from those stresses. It was a tough lifestyle. You know, people were hungry a lot of the time. When we look at the world today, I can honestly say from an anthropological perspective, there is no better time to live in terms of human health. Every year in America and the West generally today, the life expectancy goes up by a third of a year. If it went up by a year every year, none of us would ever die, right? So going up by 4 months a year is pretty good. And we have better health today than we've ever had. Now, we look around and we see problems, right? Wow, you know, Americans are more obese than any other population. We have these diseases of affluence are diseases that our ancestors wished that they had to deal with, right? Gee, there's so much to eat. I don't have to run around so much. I can entertain myself by watching television, reading books.
So it sounds like you really don't share this kind of romance of our Paleolithic ancestors. I mean, you've devoted your career to studying these people, but the Rousseauian noble savage, it sort of doesn't do much for you.
You know, I love going out and finding fossils. I love being in the field, but I love coming back and having a shower. You know, I have to say that, you know, I've been all over the world and I can appreciate the ways that people live. And it's true of hunter-gatherers as much as anybody. You know, the stories that they share, the abilities that they have to maintain these rich cultural lives, you know, that's really the basis of what it means to be human. And that's something that's very deep for us. You know, sharing stories, working together, cooperating, that's more and more a part of what it means to be human. And as we discover more about ancient people, we find those elements of them. But if I had a time machine to go back and live with ancient people, you know, I would want to interrupt my trip every week or two and come back for a shower. I would want the vaccinations. You know, I would want the things that we have now. We really have made life better. I have to say, you know, I teach students and every year I come in and my students are like, you know, things are not so great now. The world is going downhill. You know, things are going terribly. And I'm like, you know, things are going pretty well. We have enough to eat. Our children don't die, you know, nearly as much as they did in every human society in the past, it's good to have your parents with you until they're old. It's good to have your children survive. I think we haven't suffered from it, I don't think. I think we've built better cultures, more, at least richer cultures, by virtue of keeping people and making them a part of our society and not having it just be the survivors.
John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He studies the genetics of ancient humans. Steve Paulson spoke with him. So what do you think about the paleo lifestyle? Are you a fan? You can chime in on our Facebook page. And coming up, a real live caveman, the New Mexico artist known as the Cave Digger. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. We've been talking about the caveman diet and fitness movement. Now, let's meet a real caveman. New Mexico artist Ra Poulette digs caves, by hand, one shovelful at a time. He's the subject of a film that was nominated for an Academy Award this year called Cave Digger. And Charles Monroe Kane tracked down the artist and the director. Charles, what's the backstory?
It's amazing. You know, Ra, he's a laborer. He was not an artist. And one day he saw in northern New Mexico some high school kids who basically made a drinking cave. They had hidden it and dig a cave for themselves. And he saw it and he looked at the material and how it looked. And he's like, I want to do that. And ever since then, for the last 30 years, he has been digging caves.
Where?
Well, like I said, in northern New Mexico, what he does literally just digs down, goes down sometimes 3-4 stories deep, and makes these immaculately gorgeous caves, puts holes from the ground down so the light fills inside of them, carves them with ornate. It's like Gaudi, Frank Lloyd Wright. It's pretty impressive.
I've seen the photos, and they're not just great big holes in the ground. I mean, they look like – it's like walking into the inside of a seashell.
Oh, that's good. It is like a seashell. It's kind of like a modern – natural cathedral. You know, they're hard to describe. It's one of the things I asked the director, Jeff Karoff. I said, what's it like when you walk into one of these things?
You are in the wilderness, and then there are suddenly a set of stairs there, and that stairs leads to a little entranceway and to a beautiful door. Walking into his cave, there is a certain construction of it that's like Frank Lloyd Wright house, where you walk in and the ceiling is low and the space is constrained, and then you go through a passageway and then the space opens up, which is what happens when you go around this, you know, subtle corner that Ra created. And then suddenly you're looking at these walls that are sculpted in very sensuous patterns, and there's light pouring in, which is just improbable to begin with, because Ra had put an enormous skylight in there. It's a breathtaking experience.
Ra, how do you do this? I mean, what tools do you use? How do you actually carve the caves?
It's all hand tools. The first process is just the excavation of space. The space as shape, and the first thing I'm looking for is a way out. I go in, and then I come back up and bring in the light and use the light a lot of times for my ideas of how the shape of the space is going to be underneath it. The process is so slow, it's a very, very step-by-step thing. And in the process of actually digging, I see various turning points. It evolves out of that process of just looking into the solidness.
That's an interesting thing that you just said, that you see ways as you begin to dig. Because if you can imagine how it really works is that Ra is digging into a space, and so the what's right in front of his face is a wall of mountain. There isn't anything to see. He has to actually imagine what's there and then pursue what he's imagining. So it's a kind of a reverse sculpture, and it's kind of the opposite of building because it's all extraction. It's a very peculiar skill to have. I think peculiar is a good word because he might be the only person that has this skill.
It seems you're a loner artist type, and I'm surprised that you would allow someone into your life. I mean, he's talking to your wife, he's talking to your friends, he's talking to people that don't like you, he's talking about your art, he's interrupting you while you're making art. Why did you let someone make a documentary about you?
Well, it's true that I have been a hermit, but I'm not the Ted Kaczynski type hermit.
That's probably good.
Yes, it is good. I love people. And Jeffrey is a fellow artist, and he approached me, I was happy to be a part of his self-expression.
I'm curious, and I was so surprised when I watched the film about this. Most of your caves, which I will add are spectacular, they're not finished. They're about 80-90% done, you say, and they're not finished. Why aren't they finished? Why didn't you finish them?
It was, a process that wasn't contractually definitive of what we were going to end up with. So I wasn't in control of... Usually I would just take control of where it was going because I have to allow the process to be in control of itself. But the one thing that the owner would have would be the ability just to stop it at certain stages.
Well, I want to interrupt here so people understand. Most of these caves are on private land, and most of these caves are commissioned. They're done by patrons, and they pay you. It takes you 3 or 4 years. You make a cave on their land. And what happens, it seems, is that people... Either you go over budget, you go over time, or they just say, hey, it's good enough, it's done. And you're like, no, I have an artistic expression that I want to finish it. And it seems like there's a lot of tension there. And to me, all this leads to, for both of you, to the most interesting part of the film. The biggest tension of the film is, Ra, your decision to not work with patrons anymore.
Well, Paula, my wife, had, you know, why can't we have a cave?
Fair enough.
Yeah. Heard that for quite a few years. And I said, we don't really have the material for it. And there was, after a series of unsatisfying, you know, projects and things, I thought, well, I'm going to go and dig in my backyard.
And what happened?
That's when a big chunk, a Volkswagen-sized chunk, came out of the ceiling. You know, that night, I called up Jeffrey and I said, well, I said, the cave project is ended in my backyard.
Jeffrey, I want to ask you about that moment because you recorded that phone call. I got to admit, it gave me chills because at this point in the film, you're into Ra. Like, Ra's the hero, right? You're making these great films. It's this great art, these amazing caves. You're really understanding the process. And then it falls apart. How did you feel when you got that phone call?
You know, I have to say that I recorded that call without permission, but Ra has excused me since then. Something that I
sorry,
really
I didn't mean
appreciate.
To bring up a sore subject.
It happened at 3:14. A very exciting process came to a very abrupt conclusion. I had a Volkswagen-sized piece fall out of a pillar. It was very definitive. It was very definitive that the project is too dangerous. You know, I can't, I no longer have faith in this layered material, and I certainly can't make a place that I'm going to open up to others. I want to take the last bit of juice in my life and do something significant. I really thought, this pillar project was it.
Ra, why didn't you mourn, even for a moment, for what happened? Because I did. I was watching the film like, oh, my God.
Well,
why didn't you mourn at all?
You know, it's not that exceptional behavior, I'm afraid. If we look around the world, every once in a while there's a thing on the news where somebody is just, you know, tornadoes come by and just taken everything away, and they always make the statement, well, at least I'm okay. And they can be sometimes even philosophical about it. The way I felt about it is that project, there was never to be a cave there. And I was unaware of that until I found that out through a very dramatic moment in which I escaped any injury. So, you know, so that kind of puts it into another perspective where I was. Yeah, it is a lot of work, but...
I think you're being a bit modest about your lack of attachment to things. And I think that that's part of what is compelling about watching the film is that Ra is a person for whom process really does supersede product. It's sort of a cliche to talk about it, you know, enjoy the moment and be here now and all of that. But I think Ra is a person who really does that.
Ra, how do you see yourself? Are you a visionary, a romantic, an artist, an idealist? I'm curious. I was trying to describe you to someone, and I said you're an artist. I'm like, oh, that's not good enough.
In the world, I've always felt like an outsider, but not an outsider looking in, an outsider looking out. And I think the world describes those people as visionaries, which I think that's a very, you know, exaggerated romantic term. I think there's some people who are what I would call scouts, who are kind of self-involved in a way that they go off into their own world and explore and do things that aren't building upon something that already exists. And I think that's where my gift is in developing new starting points.
Ra Poulette is the subject of the 2014 Academy Award-nominated documentary short called Cave Digger, directed by Jeffrey Karoff. Charles Monroe Kane spoke with them. If you want to see some of those caves, we've got photos and videos on our website at ttbook.org.
For a moment, the strange wolf stopped. Then it moved forwards again. The cub couldn't see it very clearly because his eyes weren't nearly as sharp as his nose and ears, but as it splashed across the fast wet, he made out that this was a very strange wolf indeed. It walked on its hind legs.
Ian McKellen, reading from Michelle Paver's best-selling children's series, Wolf Brother.
The fur on its head was black, and so long that it reached right down to its shoulders, and strangest of all, it had no tail. Suddenly the strange wolf took another gulp and jerked its great claw away from the cub's belly. Then it sat down heavily in the mud and clutched the cub to its chest. The cub's terror vanished. Through the strange, furless hide that smelt more of not wolf than wolf, he could hear a comforting thump, thump, like the sound he heard when he clambered on top of his father for a nap. The cub wriggled out of the strange wolf's grip, put his forepaws on its chest, and stood on his hind legs. He began to lick the strange wolf's muzzle. Angrily, the strange wolf pushed him away, and he fell backwards. Undeterred, he righted himself and sat gazing up at the strange wolf. Such an odd, flat, furless face. The lips weren't black like a proper wolf's, but pale. And the ears were pale too, and they didn't move at all. But the eyes were silver-grey and full of light, the eyes of a wolf. The cub felt better than he had since the fast wet had come. He'd found a new pack brother.
A wolf cub and an orphan boy become best friends in Wolf Brother. The first of Michelle Paver's best-selling series of children's books, Chronicles of Ancient Darkness. The books tell the story of 12-year-old Torak and his wolf as they struggle to survive in the vast forest of Stone Age Europe. To write them, Michelle Paver not only studied archaeology and anthropology, she also lived with the Inuit of Alaska and the Sami of Lapland. She says she's been obsessed with the Stone Age for a long time.
It goes back to before I could read. My parents had a great big book of beautiful, very accurate illustrations of life in the Stone Age, which I still have. And I used to lie on my tummy in the sitting room and just look at these. And I wanted to do that. And when I grew a little older, when I was 10, I wanted to live like the Stone Age people. So I got rid of my bed and slept on the floor, and I saved up my pocket money, and I bought a rabbit, a dead rabbit from the butcher's. And I took it to the garage and I skinned it because I wanted to make clothes. Of course, it was a little bunny, so it wasn't big enough. But and my parents were brilliant. They let me do this sort of thing. I wanted a wolf as well. There, they said, they drew the line. I mean, perhaps because I lived in Wimbledon, as I still do, South London. So, you know. But that, I think, it's the childhood idea of, you know, building your own shelter and making your clothes out of animals and I suppose, not going to school, that had a large part to do with it.
So it sounds like your fascination with the prehistoric world goes way, way back to childhood. But what is it about that period of time that appeals to you today as a writer?
Well, I couldn't have predicted it, really, because when at the time of looking to start the first book, Wolf Brother, I thought, well, you know, I just want to write an adventure story. It'll be set in the Stone Age because that's going to be exciting. And then I wanted to make it real. I mean, that the point was I wanted to make the reader, whether they're 10 or 15, really feel that they're having the adventure with Torak and Wren and Wolf. So I thought, well, I better find out what it's like, did some archaeological research, and then the whole thing snowballed from there because I realised that the hunter-gatherer, I just, by accident, really, or because of my childhood, I'd chosen this incredibly interesting time because the hunter-gatherers think differently from us. And, of course, the big one was if you kill an animal, which you have to do, I don't think there were any vegetarians in the Stone Age, if you kill an animal, you've really got to treat it with respect and not waste any part of it because that would be showing disrespect to the powers that rule the forest and then maybe they wouldn't send any more animals and then you die. And so, without, you know, wanting to preach a message, these books, nothing about a message, but in the first book, Wolf Brother, Torak, you know, he's been orphaned by this bear and so he's got to kill his first deer and take it to bits and use everything. And I know, as a 10-year-old, I would have loved that. It's just fascinating.
Carefully, Torak took aim. The buck raised its head, water dripping from its muzzle. Torak watched it snuff the air and fluff out its pale rump fur in alarm. Another heartbeat, and it would be gone. He loosed his arrow. It thudded into the buck's ribs just behind the shoulder. With a graceful shudder, the buck folded its knees and sank to the ground. Torak gave a shout and pushed through the undergrowth towards it. Wolf raced him and easily won, but then pulled back to let Torak catch up. The cub was learning to respect the lead wolf. Panting, Torak stood over the buck. Its ribs were still heaving, but death was near. Its three souls were getting ready to leave. Torak swallowed. Now he had to do what he'd seen Far do countless times, but for him it would be the first time, and he had to get it right. Kneeling beside the buck, he put out his hand and gently stroked its rough, sweaty cheek. The buck lay quiet under his palm. "You did well," Torak told it. His voice sounded awkward. "You were brave and clever, and you kept going all day. I promised to keep the pact with the world spirit and treat you with respect. Now, go in peace."
I think because he had a greater understanding than I do of his surroundings, there's so much that I hope I keep the balance of, you know, him actually loving it, you know, and really enjoying it and having a great time because, after all, he doesn't have to go to school. You know, he has a wolf for a friend and he knows so much because he's just grown up in the forest. You know, a hunter-gatherer knows their surroundings really well. They've got a great sense of direction usually, which I don't have. That's why I gave a good one to Torak. And he knows about the birds and the animals and the rocks because everything he needs for survival he's got to find or make from what's just around him. And I think that's what also fascinated me as a child.
Michelle, if you could go back in time 6,000 years to the time of Torak and his friends, what questions would you have that you would want answered?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, of course, we don't really know what they looked like. Obviously, they looked, you know, in sort of physical terms like you or me, but the very few bodies we found have had tattoos on them. I mean, there was this famous, I think he's been nicknamed Iceman. He's about 5,500 years old. He was found on the sort of border between Italy and Switzerland. He had some tattoos on him, and that gave me the idea for the clan tattoos. I'd love to see how they looked, because I think most of the evidence is that, you know, people take a lot of trouble with their appearances. I don't think they would have been any different. And the other great thing, of course, is their stories. What stories did they tell? I've tried to make up stories for them, really. You know, that Torak's journey from Wolf Brother when he's a young lad of 12 to fighting the Soul Eaters, the forces of evil, all the way through to Ghost Hunter, is really a cycle of six books of him discovering his world. You know, he goes to the sea in the far north and then to the mountains in Ghost Hunter. And I've kind of created, I hope, a sort of legend for the Stone Age people, the hunter-gatherers. But what stories did they tell? Because, of course, for them, the world was old. You know, it stretched back thousands of years, and they probably had their own sort of canon of stories. So I think, really, the great mystery for me as a storyteller would be to ask them to tell me some stories. That would be fascinating. Sit round the fire with their greatest storyteller, their clan mage, whoever, and hear them telling their stories.
He longed to howl a reply, to tell Wolf that it was not forever, that one day he would find some way for them to be together. But he couldn't think how to say it, because in Wolf talk there is no future. Instead, he said it in his own speech. He knew that Wolf wouldn't understand, but he also knew that he was making the promise to himself as much as to Wolf. "Some day," he called, and his voice rang through the radiant air. "Some day we will be together. We will hunt together in the forest. Together!" His voice broke. "I promise! My brother, the wolf!" No answer came back, but Torak had not expected one. He had made his promise. Then he turned and started back towards the forest.
Ian McKellen reading from Wolf Brother, the first of Michelle Paver's best-selling series of children's books, Chronicles of Ancient Darkness. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
I'm Ginger Strand, and my dangerous idea is that we should all just throw those plastic bottles out the windows of our cars. I am an environmentalist, and as an environmentalist, I've always believed in the gospel of recycle, reduce, reuse, recycle. What I never realized was how much worse a solution recycling is than the first two R's. It happened when I was working on writing a magazine article. I started researching the history of bottle deposit laws. What I discovered was that recycling was actually thought up by the packaging companies. They joined together to form an industry organization called Keep America Beautiful in 1953. And that was because the state of Vermont had just passed a bottle law. The bottle law that Vermont passed didn't mandate recycling. It didn't even institute a bottle deposit. It banned disposable bottles. If you couldn't refill it, you couldn't sell it. Industry really wanted disposables. It's because the Second World War had just ended and the aluminum industry had this excess of aluminum capacity, and they figured that disposables were a fantastic way to keep selling lots and lots of aluminum. But the problem is people were throwing all their disposable bottles and cans all over the countryside, and nobody liked how that looked. So the packaging industry figured out a bunch of kind of half measures. They came up with the term litter bug. They encouraged people to put litter bags in their cars, and they sent crews of people out to pick up trash on these Keep America Beautiful outings. But behind the scenes, Keep America Beautiful was actually fighting bottle deposit laws, and that's why only 10 states have them today. Aluminum cans are actually really good. They're 96% recoverable. They can be turned into new aluminum cans. That is not true of plastic. Most plastic doesn't actually get recycled. It gets downcycled. In other words, it gets turned into things like fleece or polyester carpet. So this is the heretical part of my idea. In the end, bottle deposit laws, even recycling, have only actually made things worse. Even though everyone assumes it makes environmental sense, if you look at the big picture, it doesn't. It makes the world look better, but that shouldn't be enough. Plastic recycling makes the world work worse. The reason is because it's not a real solution. It makes us think it's a solution. We think, oh, I'll just recycle it when we buy the plastic bottle of water, and that kind of absolves us of the guilt. I'm as guilty of this as anyone. I'll carry that empty bottle around in my bag for days. And then, you know, when I put it in the recycling bin, I don't feel so bad. So the end result is that we produce more of this wasteful stuff than ever before. So what if we all started throwing our plastic bottles out the windows of our cars again? It wouldn't take long before the highways would look pretty bad and people would start complaining. No one wants to look at that. But it would point out the fundamental truth that recycling is not the answer. The real answers are reducing and reusing.
Ginger Strand's dangerous idea about recycling, or rather, not recycling. She is a writer and author of the novel Flight and Killer on the Road. This week, David Mitchell's best-selling novel The Bone Clocks is on our minds. Mitchell is a literary virtuoso, best known for his 2004 novel Cloud Atlas. He writes these intricate novels. They weave together multiple narrators, interconnected stories, even different genres, all within one book. So now he's done it again with The Bone Clocks. It veers from the story of a young runaway girl to a cosmic battle between two groups of immortal beings. Steve Paulson asked him to read a passage from the beginning of the novel, narrated by the book's main character, young Holly Sykes.
I was 7 years old in 1976. I heard voices in my head, not mad or drooly or especially scary even, at least not at first. The radio people, I called them, because at first I thought there was a radio on in the next room, only there never was a radio on in the next room. I knew hearing voices wasn't normal, but they weren't actually harming me, so maybe it was just one of those secrets people live with. One night I had a nightmare about killer bees loose in the Captain Marlowe, and I woke up in a sweat. A lady was sat at the end of my bed saying, "Don't worry, Holly, it's all right." And I said, "Thanks, Mum, because who else could it be?" Then I heard Mum laughing in the kitchen down the corridor. That was how I knew I'd only dreamt the lady on my bed, and I switched on the light to prove it. And sure enough, nobody was there. "Don't be afraid," said the lady, "but I'm as real as you are." I didn't scream or freak out. I mean, sure, I was shaking, but even in my fear, I felt it was like a puzzle or a test. There was nobody in my room, but someone was speaking to me. So, as calm as I could, I asked the lady if she was a ghost. "Not a ghost," said the lady who wasn't there, "but a visitor to your mind." I asked what my visitor's name was. "Miss Constantine," she said. Then she was gone. It took me ages to fall asleep, but by the time I did, I sort of felt I'd made a friend.
Oh, that is great. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And it turns out Miss Constantine is not exactly a friend.
No. She's a double or treble or quadruple kind of an agent, but yeah.
Now, David, how would you describe your main character, Holly Sykes, and this is the voice of the young Holly Sykes we've just heard, and how she figures into the narrative structure of this book?
Well, she's a complex kid. She's 15, pretty solidly working class. Her parents run a pub. And I hope she's likable, she's tough, and she's really the linking device between all of the six parts of my novel. She's the narrator in both the first and the last section, and also she's a major character in the lives of the narrators of the other sections.
So your book spans decades, and these various sections are narrated by different characters with their own very distinctive voices, and you seem to be playing with different kinds of stories, even different genres. And I have to say, the whole thing is pretty dazzling. And
Thank you.
You like playing the genres, don't you?
Yes. I mean, if I was ficklier than I am, then I might try to modify the verb play. Genre is what my novels need to deploy to be the novel that I want to write. So throughout the book we have social realism in the 1980s in a section I just read from, but we also have something steeped in the opposite end of the social spectrum, one of entitlement and money and privilege. We have war reporting, and we have satire and pastiche. Then we have the fantastic, and then at the end we have a kind of dystopian, steeped novella to close with.
So why do you like doing that, putting all of this together in the same book, these very different styles?
I guess because I'm an omnivore, and I like to write novels that pull the rug out from under the reader's expectations. I like that being done to me when I'm a reader, if it makes sense, if it's not just stupid or done as a gimmick. I like to be surprised by favorite writers.
Now, as you've said, there are different kinds of styles that you're using here. I mean, there's one, the first section, it's kind of a sort of a story about teenage love and angst. There's another section about sort of student life in Cambridge University. And then there is also this more fantastical part, which kind of runs throughout the story, really a cosmic supernatural battle between the forces of good and evil. Why did you want to incorporate that into the story?
By looking at immortality, it licenses me to think about mortality. Now, I could have done that by setting the whole thing in a care home or write a classic midlife crisis novel about someone who notices he's getting older and as a response to that buys a sports car, obtains an inappropriate mistress and runs for office. But there were already books like that out there, and some are really good, but that just wasn't what was floating my boat. I wanted to look at this thorny topic about how to develop a saner relationship with aging. And I tried to do that by putting at the heart of the novel this Faustian pact and this question, really. If you could cheat death, if you could retain the youth and health and squanderable bank account of days and time that you have in your 20s, what would you be willing to pay for that? Would you be willing to amputate your conscience, for example, if that deal cost innocent people their souls or their lives? Would you be willing to fake your death every 10, 15 years and leave behind your family and everyone you love before people start to notice you're not getting any older? Now, this is a sort of fantastical way to look at issues about mortality, but it's what I wanted to do. As it happens, I hope it makes a page-turning narrative. I hope it's fresh and original.
There's a lot of, I guess what I would call paranormal stuff that's happening here. I mean, there's sort of a whole cosmology that you develop. I mean, there are people with psychic abilities. They hear voices and channel other spirit beings. There are telepathic, even precognitive abilities. People can sort of predict the future. And I'm wondering if, is this just all good literary fun, or do you take these ideas seriously at all?
It's mostly good literary fun, but the world's a mysterious place and the laws of physics are not written in concrete. They have cracks, and the next generation of scientists explore these cracks, and there's cracks in those theories as well. And the generation after explores those cracks and finds newer, deeper, more underlying laws of physics in the nature of matter and the nature of mind. So I wouldn't rule out anything that I've written either.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Have you had any experiences like this? I mean, what we would classify as paranormal experiences, you know, uncanny coincidences, clairvoyant dreams, that kind of thing?
Nothing that I wouldn't put down to possible coincidence, except one visit from a ghost when I was living in Japan, aged about 26 or so. That was fairly... I can't really rationalize that away.
Can you tell us what happened?
I was just woken up in the middle of the night by a very strong presence standing at the end of my bed that wanted to know what I was doing in that house. So I was wide awake and not as calm as I'm making this sound. But eventually I explained what I was doing there and The presence didn't go, but I felt that it had accepted my explanation and I was allowed to go back to sleep, so I did, and that was it. That was it. How about you? Have you ever had anything like that?
I have not, at least things that I can sort of explain away, but I have people close to me who have.
Yeah. There's a lot of it about, most of it sort of, I think, is explicable within a scientific or psychiatric paradigm. But even the sort of the edges of these paradigms are not clear cut and they get hazy. And this sort of meshes quite well with what the novel is. The novel is this sort of big, baggy form where inexactitude and the inchoate can thrive and prosper and be turned into and used by narrative.
Well, there's one thing I'm curious about. The Bone Clocks has gotten a huge amount of praise and acclaim, but there's also been a common refrain among certain critics who wish you'd just give up the magic and, you know, stick to the real-world characters and plots. What do you make of that criticism?
It's not my job to think about it that much. I mean, I'm a novelist, and this book needed this fantastical element in. I didn't have any choice. It wouldn't have been the book I wanted to write had I exorcised it of the places where the laws of the natural world are bent. This is what the book needed to be, so this is how I wrote it. So, kind of, why not? Almost who cares? I mean, surely what matters is the book any good or not? And why can't literary novels contain elements of the fantastical? What about The Master and Margarita, written by Mikhail Bulgakov, set in, I think, 1930s Stalinist Moscow, where we have a talking cat, where the devil comes to Moscow to hold and wants an essentially banquet, where Jesus Christ and Pontius Pilate meet and converse. It's a brilliant, brilliant novel. And does everything have to read like a late Henry James novel for it to be any good? Really? What about Midnight's Children? What about 100 Years of Solitude? Maybe I nailed my true colours to the mast more visibly than I meant to then, but kind of come on is how I feel. You know.
That's David Mitchell making the case for the fantastic in fiction. He's talking with Steve Paulson. Mitchell is the author of Cloud Atlas, and he's just come out with a brand new novel called The Bone Clocks. That's what's on our minds this week, and we post new On Our Minds segments on our website every day. That's at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show, with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Craig Ely, and Raymond Tungekar. Our theme music was composed by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.